members of the faculties, members of the student body, and more particularly, those of you who have come to the University of British Columbia for the first time. I'm most happy to be able to welcome you back to the university after the summer months, or into the university as a member of our university family. I hope that this year will be enjoyable and satisfactory to all of us. Now, if any of those who are standing in the rear left of me would like seats, there are seats over here on the right, though I recognize it's an easier escape from a standing position near the door than it is if you ever get down. I gather, in pretty stiff competition today, big league stuff, with the World Series on, and with the sun and the weather cooperating as it is to attract any normal human being into spending any free time, or for that matter, any stolen time, outdoors wandering about enjoying themselves. So it is a matter of satisfaction and a pride to me that so many of you have taken the trouble to come along here this morning and to spend a little time listening to my annual address, as it's called, or what I may have to say. Now, in the first place, after reading Marie Moreau on the front page of the Sun last night, I thought I better dig out one of my better dresses. So this is it. It droops a little, I grant you. And it only dates back about 500 or 600 years, when it was adopted by Cambridge, I think it is, and more recently, within the last 200 years, taken over by the universities of New Brunswick and by the universities of Toronto. But then, you know, we men, it keeps us so busy finding money to buy new clothes in terms of the changing fashions for the ladies that we just can't afford to change our fashions. So we wander about in the same old hats, in the same old suits, in the same old dilapidated ways. And you have to put up with us, and we hope love us occasionally in those circumstances. I also came across a note on my desk from a little publication to the effect that a student left Columbia University recently in disgust and sued that great institution because it hadn't taught him wisdom. Now, I suspect he must have been a law student, but I'm not sure. Obviously, while there are many things we would like to do to you and for you, we can't teach you wisdom. And there's no use suing us if you're not satisfied with your wisdom or lack of it when you leave. The title of this address is Annus Mirabilis et Horrendus. McGregor, Professor McGregor in classics, or some of the other in classics, will give you the proper interpretation for that. But in brief, our contemporary language, it's been a marvelous but bloody awful year. And I use bloody awful in more senses than one, including the more accurate ones. More specifically, it has been a year of remarkable events and of terrifying possibilities. And that's why I have selected the title that I have, and why I have added a couple of pages to what I had originally written to give, because I thought in the circumstances, in view of your age and status, it would be worth commenting upon. The 12 months that have passed since I spoke to a similar audience in this armory a year ago have been among the most exciting and portentous in history. On the international front, the launching of Sputnik, the first of the Russian satellites, surprised and shocked all of us and gave us a brief glance into possibilities of the future. And twice we've been on the brink of another world war, once in the Middle East, and more recently, off the Straits of Formosa. Now, the underlying causes of these situations have not been removed, and either or both of them could flare up and yet be the occasion of that war which we all fear and dread, which, if it does come, will mean the destruction of the world that we know. The bitter conflict in Algiers and Cyprus, continuing difficulties in respect of race in South Africa and Little Rock, and unprecedented numbers of costly labor disputes in our own province, and shifts in our Canadian defense policy are all symptoms of unsolved problems and evidence of the uneasy world in which we live. I do not have time to deal with any of these in detail, but I would like to mention only the first and the last. Sputnik was and is a direct challenge to our society, and particularly to those of us engaged in education. For the world of the future will belong to those who are best able to control and use the forces of nature, and are best able to organize and inspire or control human nature and human beings. In the past few years, there has been a new trend and emphasis in Canadian defense policy. The implications of this are far-reaching and will affect everyone in this audience. Now, the facts of Canadian defense policy are fairly simple, because due to the size of our population and wealth, we are quite incapable of defending ourselves against modern weapons in the hands of one of the giants. We are left, therefore, with two or three choices. The first is to leave our defense as part of the defense of the continent, the United States, and let her pay for it. The second is to join with other nations, including the United States, in a general defense arrangement in which we might play an appropriate role. And that was the real objective and attempt in NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And the third, the one which we seem to be adopting, is that of becoming a northern projection of the United States defense. In this arrangement, we buy their weapons. We're trained and directed by them. And we provide their forces with bases and facilities in appropriate areas across our country. Because of this, it seems to me that in future, practically all the research and development involved in weapons will be done in the United States. And if this be true, bright young men and women will flow south across the line, where their brains, their abilities, and their training will be put to the most effective use. It also means, or may mean, that the best and the more adventurous of our labor force will be more likely to find suitable employment at Boeing's in Seattle than at Avro in Toronto. Now, all of this in the circumstances may be necessary. And if so, we should be the last to complain or criticize. I'm concerned with pointing out, however, that this may mark a turning point or the end of an era in 300 years of our history in which Canadians, in the face of almost insuperable obstacles and against the natural lines of development, have struggled to be free and to create a Canadian nation of which they can be proud. I mention this in passing. I wish I had time to develop it, but for the time being, I leave it with you to discuss and think about it. For you, because of your age, are the men and women who will be affected by it most. And now, I would like to move on to the more immediate issues affecting the university and our own local community in Vancouver and British Columbia. The year 1958, as you all know, has been an extremely interesting and busy one for all of us in British Columbia, and it's particularly true at the university. In January and February, we carried out the active phases of our first appeal to the public for funds to enable us to provide additional accommodation for the growing numbers of young men and women who come to us each year. Here we were successful, beyond the expectations of the professionals who advised us, and even beyond the hopes of many within the university itself. And all across Canada, men and women in industry and in private capacity not only gave generously, but in giving expressed their high regard for our university and their appreciation of the services which it has rendered and is rendering to the whole of Canada and to the world at large. To date, we have been given in excess of $8.5 million, and we fully expect that before long we will reach 10. The provincial government has promised two contributions. The first promise made in 1955, to the effect that the government and legislature would give us $1 million every year for a period of 10 years for building purposes. The second promise made last year was that the government and legislature would match dollar for dollar all of the other contributions made to the university over a 10-year period and up to a $10 million total. In the meantime, the federal government, through the Canada Council, had set aside $50 million to be distributed among the universities of Canada, again on a matching basis, for buildings designed to promote and to advance the arts, humanities, and social sciences. Our share of this on a per capita basis will be about $4.5 million. And the net result is that when all of these promises have been fulfilled, we will have spent for new buildings something of the order of $35 million. And you will see on campus at the present time a good deal of excavation, and during the term I suspect that your lectures will be less audible than in normal circumstances by reason of construction work going on around you. Then in 1958 we have been celebrating the centennial of the province and the golden jubilee of the granting of the charter to the university. During the summer, the university, we were honored with the visits of the Prince of the Netherlands and of Her Royal Highness the Princess Margaret. On both occasions, we arranged for special congregations and awarded our distinguished visitors honorary degrees. Our summer school has been growing in numbers, in importance, and in the variety and distinction of the courses and opportunities which it offers. This year, we had over 4,500 students enrolled, and I suspect it's the largest, for what that's worth, in Canada. One of the most exciting features of this summer school is the work done in the various fields of the fine arts. As most of you know, a group of public-spirited men and women in Vancouver, of whom Dean Andrew was one of the most important, this year launched the first Vancouver International Festival of the Arts. This proved to be a most distinguished success. In respect of the excellence of the performance offered and the distinction of the artists who accepted invitations to come to Vancouver and perform, and by and large, in respect of the audiences which paid admissions to hear these artists. I mention this because I think it's fair to say that our Summer School of the Arts over the past few years has developed a climate in which it was possible to plan for such an ambitious venture, and in addition, provided much of the background and the practical experience necessary for undertakings of this kind. I hope and expect the Vancouver Festival will become an annual and West Coast equivalent of the festivals at Stratford, Edinburgh, and Salisbury. But I hope, too, that our own Summer School of the Arts, as well as the summer courses given for credit, will grow and develop and mature and attract to this campus increasing numbers of promising and able young men and women from all across the continent and the world. Now, 1958 has produced an unusually large number of conferences and meetings, both in Canada and abroad, concerned with and engaged in the business of discussing the problems of education. Among these meetings, the 7th Congress of the Universities of the British Commonwealth, they're held every 5 years, by the way, was held for the first time outside Great Britain, and it was held in late August and early September in Montreal and Toronto, and it was perhaps the most distinguished of all, in that it brought together in Canada representatives not only from all of the universities of the Commonwealth, but a representative group of those in charge of the affairs of the best of the American institutions, and in addition, the members of the Executive Committee of the International Universities Association, representing all universities throughout the world. Following these meetings, most of the members traveled across the continent, and during the past 10 days, nearly 100 of them were our guests, and they expressed themselves as delighted with our environment and with the vitality and the optimism of this relatively young institution. Incidentally, they all agreed with the claims that we continue to make, that this university has the most beautiful and appropriate physical setting of any university in the world. Last week, as I imagine all of you were aware, we held a symposium on the humanities and the liberal arts, and we opened the new Buchanan building, and we conferred degrees at special congregations upon distinguished academic heads and other leaders in the public life of Canada. Now, normally, we do not give honorary degrees to those actively engaged in politics. But because of the special circumstances of this year, and because it happens only once in every 100 years, we felt and we believe that it was good and wise that this good and wise policy should be suspended. And so we had with us the Prime Minister of Canada, the Premier of the province, the leaders of the principal opposition parties, and other distinguished public men. Now, in some ways, it would have been easier to have held these congregations earlier in the year, but all of us were anxious that our students should be involved in these ceremonies and activities, and that they should feel in a direct and personal way, that is, the students, that they are an integral part of the university, and can and should participate in its affairs and accept appropriate responsibility for its activities. However, this address is directed particularly to those of you who have come to the university for the first time. And it's intended to provide me as your president with the formal opportunity of extending to you a warm welcome on behalf of all of us. We hope that you will enjoy your years with us. We hope, too, that you will achieve here some of the things that you really desire and that will be of interest and use to you throughout the rest of your lives. It is my practice, and I believe it to be a necessary and desirable one, to tell our new students that we expect them to behave as responsible and mature human beings and to accept responsibility for themselves and for the good name and the reputation of their university. We in North America, and this includes Canada and British Columbia, are perhaps the most wasteful and one of the most untidy and even careless civilizations the world has ever known. I have in mind the extravagant way in which we exploit many of our natural resources and the disregard we have for the tidiness of our parks and highways and things of the kind. So far as the students at the university are concerned, I have in mind particularly the disregard which some of you have for the appearance of this, the loveliest campus in the world. And I might say that I let some of my colleagues look at this, and they thought I was being a little rude and tough. But I don't think you mind being told things in plain English. In any event, I'm going to tell you them. The fact is that many of you trail and leave litter about, lunch bags, bottles, and garbage, in a disgraceful and untidy manner. You walk across lawns in muddy weather, and some among you have not too much regard for the appearances and conditions of the interior of buildings that you occupy. Now, I know, as I have stated above, that you are not unique in this respect, for this is part of the pattern of our society, community, and civilization. But you are unique in that you are being given the opportunity of continuing in your education at university level. And many of you in the years to come will be the leaders of your respective communities in the province and in the nation. It is our hope and our duty, too, to try to make you see that while you are with us, matters of this kind, and particularly the acceptance of responsibility for your own individual and corporate affairs, are important and should be accepted and carried out. In addition, I should remind you, too, that we who are your seniors will try to keep this university an attractive and efficient place. That additional work, which these actions I've described may result in, does cost a substantial amount of money to remedy. And in the final analysis, these costs are paid and will be paid by members of the student body out of the fees that are charged them. So it's a practical matter as well as an aesthetic one, ladies and gentlemen. Now, from what I have just said, you may have gathered, Marie Moreau, I like to scold students, and that I take rather a dim view of our student body. The facts are that we are intensely proud of you, and I know no other university across Canada or across the world in which the students have played such an important and generous role as have the students at the University of British Columbia. You are responsible for the conduct of your own student affairs, and these have been conducted in a highly satisfactory way. You have taken the initiative in urging governments and public to begin, to continue, and to increase their support of the university. You have given generously out of your own limited resources in a way that no other university students have done. As graduates and alumni, your predecessors have continued their interest in and support of their alma mater in a most generous and active way. For all of this, I and all of my colleagues are most grateful. Now, turning for a moment to the university and to university policy for the future, there can be no question now in anybody's mind but that we have arrived and that we have become accepted and are in the process of becoming one of the largest universities in Canada. My own view is that from here on, bigness and the multiplication of faculties and schools, departments and courses will all take care of themselves and are, in a sense, inevitable. But because of this, I feel that our future goal should be excellence in everything that we do or attempt. Saying this, I do not mean to imply that we have not been good and are not now good. I do mean that over the years that have passed, our main concern has had to be to build the foundations, to keep the university a living and a vital force, and to persuade her constituents, the public and the governments, that we are important and essential. Now, I believe that they now know all of this. And while throughout the 50 years since our charter was granted, we have attempted with very considerable success to establish and maintain high standards in the various areas for which we are responsible and have achieved them, I do believe that for the future, our chief concern must be with excellence in all that we do. And because the abilities and the temperaments and characters of students and staff will determine this excellence, so far as we can, we should see to it that those who come to us are the best and the ablest of the young men and women of our nation, and that those who teach them and who in the preparation for teaching or in what spare time they may have for research will be the very best that we can find and persuade to join us and stay with us. Now, money does not solve every problem, but adequate money is necessary in the affairs of any institution. Adequate money can be one of the basic essentials upon which to build for excellence. Each year, the salaries of our teaching and research staff have been increased, and it is the policy of the university and of the Board of Governors to try to ensure that just as soon as possible, we will provide and maintain salaries and living conditions as good as, at least, as those in any other university in Canada. I mention this not only to place it upon the record, but to bring to the attention of the students, and particularly new students, the fact that one of the main sources of revenue is students' fees. Over the past 15 years, our student fees have been contributing less and less to our total costs of operation. And during that period, we have made only two increases in our fees, and those modest ones. They were made in 1948, and again in 1950. Fees in 1945 were academic fees, $160. In 1958, the academic fees are $222. In 1945, AMS fees, or student control fees, were $13. In 1958, they're $24. We have increased, as I say, our fees twice. And the present academic fees are, as I say, $222. And it may be, if the student fees are to continue to play the part in the revenues of the university that they have done in the past and possibly should, may be necessary to raise them, even while I regret it, for I know how difficult it is for many students to find the money that they need to come to the university. However, this is a matter for the Board of Governors to discuss and to decide upon. If and when they do it, I am sure that they will want to consult with the representatives of the student body. And now one last word about academic affairs. For me, the most important issue within the university itself is to maintain a proper balance between and among the disciplines so as to ensure a broad and informed basis of understanding for all of the students who come to us and to whom we give degrees or diplomas. Now, there's a natural tendency and desire on the part of most of those concerned with their own specialties to think and to feel and to act on the assumption that their interests are of supreme importance and should take precedence over all others. I have had students come to me and tell me that they wanted to take courses in music appreciation. But because of the demand of professional schools and their courses, they couldn't fit it in. Now, this isn't in the nature of a criticism or a particular reflection on any faculty or any school. It is a request that, as far as it's physically possible, within the time at your disposal and within the limits of the demands of your own professional training, and I'm using professional of the humanities just as much as I am of the others, that time be found to enable your students to get the broadest and most enlightening education they possibly can while they're here with us. I've also told by students, I think inaccurately and on the basis of this understanding, that there is too little opportunity for them, while students in education, to take courses in other faculties and particularly in the faculties of arts and science. And I've been told too, and this I can understand, because it is a problem, that it's easier for those who go direct through education on the 5-year course to get certificates and finish their courses than it is for those who pursue their courses through the Faculty of Arts and Science. Now, I say I understand the reasons for this, and it may be essential and necessary. But again, I want to point out that the greatness of a university and of university education lies not alone in it technical or professional training and skill, but in the breadth and the depth of its opportunities and of its training and of its education. In the humanities, there is far too little concern and understanding of the sciences and of the applied and professional schools, and they too should keep this whole matter in mind. Now, as I indicated, the comments from students, as I have heard them, are not wholly accurate, but it does indicate an attitude, and it does suggest that our policy should be constantly under review. For in the world in which we live, and to which our students will, in due course, emerge, it is of the highest importance that all of them should have an understanding of their own society and of human nature and of the potentially terrifying problems and dangers with which that world confronts them and us. No concern for the minutiae of professional schools or departmental problems should interfere with our students' opportunities to get somewhere along the road a broad introduction to science, to the humanities, to human relationships, and to the world around us. This, for me, along with our struggle for excellence and for the maintenance of our freedom, is the real challenge to the universities and within the universities, and particularly in our own university today. Thank you.